Today is September 24th, 2019. It is 1:57 p.m. My name is Deborah Schwartz, and I'm sitting here in the Mill Valley Public Library in our sound room with Terry Haggerty. On behalf of the Mill Valley Public Library and the Mill Valley Historical Society, Terry, welcome to our rubber room.
Well, I'm honored to be here. Mill Valley's played an amazingly influential part in my life because when I discovered Mill Valley, I discovered so many amazing artistic people. And the whole direction my life was going just changed almost instantaneously with some of the poets and philosophers that I met that lived here. So,
well, and so, and who you are in all of this is Terry Haggerty. You're a musician. You play guitar and bass and piano. You've been involved with some of the most influential bands of various eras. You're a legend in the cannabis world. You're a grower, you're a seed collector, and you're a psychedelic ranger.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, you guide the dying in a transition. It seems to me, in describing you, that you're a man who has ridden the wave of opportunity and change and continue to do so, as well as the wave of transition. Would you describe yourself as that?
Yeah, I think so. I think the dynamics of all that is in every one of those things, I had some ambition. And luckily, I've been blessed by not quite succeeding at anything that I tried to do. So it seems like the really kind of soulful, connected parts never really got that messed up. But it's more grace and synchronicity than it has to do with what I would have chosen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the real wonders of going through your life, you know, that I've always felt like I really did have a guardian angel or, you know, a spiritual guide and you know, mild level of mendacity that has never risen to a completely outrageous rock and roll level.
As it can.
As it can, yeah.
So this morning when I was thinking about you, you know, you and I've met. We met at the Rancho Nicasio about a month ago, yes,
mm-hmm.
when Bill Champlin and Tamara and the Sons of Champlin were playing. And you got up on stage and you played a little yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a long history with the band. Bill has mentioned you kindly in mm-hmm. the past. And when we spoke, I felt an instant connection. And I think you're one of those guys that can connect easily with people. But this morning when thinking about the interview, I thought, what lens shall we use for Terry's interview? And I think ultimately it's a crystalline lens, mm-hmm. one that is multifaceted, that goes in a lot of different directions, but very beautiful and interesting as well. So that's the lens I'd like to use today in your interview, with your permission.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you have complete and total permission.
Okay, so before we go into that adventure, let's get just a little background history about you.
Okay.
A little bit about your family. I mean, you'll look like you've got some Northern European stock in you or something.
Okay,
Haggerty's kind of Irish, though, right?
That's the good part. So we have to go right to when my mother was dying. And she died at 91. And she called all of us together because she had congestive heart failure. So after she'd had a real bout and we thought we were going to lose her, she sprung back, and she just seemed like as good as she ever was. She called us all over, and she said, I have something really terrible I have to tell you. And we went, oh, Mom, what? She says, well, it's about my dad. And we're going, well, what about your dad? She said, he was black. And we're going, oh, my God, we've got soul.
Is this true, or is she just messing with you?
No, this is not a sad truth.
You do not look black.
My I'm only 15% Irish. Mm-hmm. So I had, 23andMe or the other one, which one of those two. Yeah. And when the tests come back, you know, I have all this Mali and Nigeria and like Libya.
Oh,
and
wow.
Almost none of my genetics are Northern European, except for, you know, my mom said it was, the story says, was a descendant of Count Barreto.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that he's one of the first guys there into Cuba that brought the Cuban royalty. And so, you know, you never really know how that is. But doing the genetic test, it really is pretty doggone funny to think that, like, you know, a quarter of my makeup would be black.
What a plot twist.
Yeah, I know. Especially this late.
She'd kept that to herself for 90 years.
She was so ashamed.
Oh, dear.
She came to this country in the early 40s, and she didn't speak any English.
And she came from?
Cuba.
And so what's your mom's name?
Gloria Belen de Gonzalez de Cerreto de Barreto de Haggerty de Byrne.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That's a lot to carry around.
Yeah. Well, that's how they do it there.
Yeah. So she came, and she didn't speak English, and where did she land? Did she come?
Well, she came here to Miami working with her dance partner, and they did shows all over, and they actually did some pretty amazing stuff. Jimmy Durante loved her, so her dance act toured with him, and she said that he was in love with her and kept on, you know, trying to give her flowers and... And he was a very nice guy, apparently.
Yes, very nice guy. And what a great performer.
Uh-huh. And let's see, then they did a movie with the Mills Brothers. And that's an amazingly beautiful thing, her section in it. It's a beautiful dance routine. And they're sitting at this table. And somehow they got their bodies to just lift right out of their bodies at the table. First, their bodies slumped over, and then these bodies, like spirits, came out of their bodies and went up into the clouds. And they do this really beautiful dance routine, and she was quite the amazing dancer.
So, that's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
And your father?
Let's see. He was born in Sparks, Nevada. Mm-hmm. His mother, Mabel Cody, was... she was any number of things. God, who knows? Maybe some pretty gnarly things. But she was a wonderful woman. I loved my grandmother. And let's see, my dad, when he was 15, he got in an argument with his stepdad and stabbed him and was sent to jail for a little bit. And then when he got out of jail, I mean, he was under 18 years old at the time, and he just started working professionally from that point on, dropped out. He finished high school eventually, dropped out of high school and started playing in Marysville. And
he's a musician then.
Yeah.
His
he's
name?
A great guitar player.
And his name, did you tell me his name?
Frank Haggerty.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked with any number of, you know, famous people. And I guess the most far-out things that he did was working in the traditional jazz world, because he got to play with, there's one show on Ed Sullivan where it's Louis Armstrong and Jack Teagardner and Red Allen I forget who the other guys were, and Dad and... And both Mom and Dad were on Ed Sullivan a couple of times performing. So over, you know, 4 or 5 year period, like, we're used to turning on the TV and seeing Mom and Dad.
So they'd hooked up by then. She was a dancer. He was a musician.
Mm-hmm. They met at the Great American Music Hall, which used to be called the Music Box.
Mm-hmm.
And he was playing in the band, and she was one of the girls that was... They used to have these stairs that came down to the floor, and the dancing girls came down that.
The spiral stairs that come down from either side.
Yeah, either side, exactly,
right.
Yeah.
And then the dancers and all the legs come pouring down.
Exactly, exactly.
Yes, with all those costumes. Those were the days.
But, you know, like my mom and her family, they knew Celia Cruz in Cuba, and her older sisters, they were all best friends. And she worked with Desi Arnaz for a while. And, I mean, just lots of really pretty high-end stuff. My Mel Torme loved my dad's guitar playing, but he eventually took a job being the assistant county recorder here in Marin County, so it got hard for him to go out on the road and travel.
So were you born and raised here in Marin?
Yes.
So tell me about where and
San Anselmo.
San Anselmo. What year were you born?
1946.
1946. Okay.
And was raised right next to the American Legion log cabin on San Francisco Boulevard.
Sure. Yeah.
And
didn't that turn into a biker bar there for a while?
I don't think it ever turned into that, but it may have. I'm not that in touch with it.
Yeah.
But went to Isabel Cook School, Drake High School.
So you're a real local.
Yeah, like a little College of Marin, a little San Francisco State, just enough to drop out and go on the road.
You come from show people, really. You could say that.
We were constantly surrounded by show business people. Every year, probably I was about, 12 years old, they started having these jam sessions at our place. And we had two lots and a big swimming pool and an extra, not a home, but a building in the back. So people could come and stay with us. And we had the most amazing musicians come up from L.A. because my dad still did studio work in Los Angeles, so he'd commute down there and come back. And over the years, it became so popular that, I mean, everybody was there at our house, and they'd line the outside of our house with chairs, two or three deep to hear the music. And
like Daryl's house.
Yeah.
With the musicians coming by, or a salon.
Right. Well, it had that quality to it. The police would show up to say it's too late. Next thing you know, they'd be dancing, and the next wave would come in, and everybody knew everybody. So there was no hanky-panky. And I think my favorite part of that whole thing, and I always tell this to kids because I was working in juvie and stuff for a while, and I would tell the kids, I said, in my day, my mom was Cuban, and a lot of the musicians basically were kind of druggies, and some of them carried weapons. And to get into our house, my mom didn't care if you did that. You just couldn't do it at our house. And so she'd literally shake everybody down and get their revolver or their knife or their cocaine or their heroin, and she just put it away on the side, and then they could get it when she went back. But as I was being raised, I was just getting this very specific education about how people behaved when they did these different drugs. So, and the potheads always seemed like the most amazingly fun guys, and they were the guys that tried to get us to go to a sushi bar in 1956, just, unheard of stuff for us. And, but when the 60s came around, and the psychedelic revolution, I've never snorted a line of cocaine in my life or done any heroin.
You haven't?
No, never.
Oh, my goodness. And
it just never even entered in my mind. It was just terrified me knowing what I knew. And I was very lucky with that I was in the hills literally tripping on LSD. Mm-hmm. And I came back to the band house. And somebody was there, and he said, I've got this amazing pink Peruvian flake. You want to try it? And so he's chopping up all these vines.
And this is a musician that's visiting?
Yeah, I don't think he was a musician. Mm-hmm. I think he was just, somebody who had it. And I remember watching everybody snort this thing and get so ecstatic and start just talking. And everybody's talking about themselves. Nobody's listening to each other. And I'm just so high on acid, I'm going, that's my problem. I surely don't need this drug. I can only imagine what this would do to me. And over the years, that ended up being the biggest reason why I left the science. And it just was,
Well, so we'll get to that in a little bit. And that you make a very important point about the influences of drugs on culture.
Because
anybody that was around back in the day when Coke was big. Mm. Yeah, you can look back and say that was an utterly narcissistic drug.
Well, some
and some tunnel vision.
Some very clever, cruel clever, states cruel. Of mind.
Yes, clever, cruel. Before we leave your family, I would like to get the names of your siblings.
Okay, I have a sister, and Issa Falk is her name now. And she's an amazingly wonderful artist. And my brother is Tim Haggerty. He lives up in Santa Rosa. And he's really an excellent musician. He's the best musician of the family. I mean, he is super competent. He plays any number of instruments, you know. He's an excellent reader, plays all kinds of music, you know. Really nice guy. And then I have two kids, Ammon, and he actually is runs one of the internet businesses, or Formation is the name of his business, and they're kind of the ethics. They define ethics of artificial intelligence.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, no, it really is very interesting. Then, as I said, my daughter is kind of head of Head Start now over in Oakland. And
she's, you said, 37?
Yeah.
And your son?
He's 48.
Okay. And I met your lovely wife. I'm guessing
Katie.
This is a second marriage?
Yeah, second marriage,
Katie,
yeah.
Right. She seems wonderful, really warm.
Yeah, no,
person.
She's very, very nice. You know, very, very smart. There's two things she said, she told me right when we met. First thing she said is, "Don't you ever tell me what I think." I went, "Oh, okay." And she says, "Nobody ever really taught you how to reason, did they?"
But that's okay. I'll still marry you.
Just pointing a couple of things out we might want to work on here.
I like him even more after
how
hearing
could you
that.
Not follow over?
Okay, so let's go back. Let's go back to a time, you know, I know that you've had a lot of experience with psychedelics, and you've met from our pre-interview discussions, and along the journey, mm-hmm. you've met some pretty interesting people. And what I'm going to ask now is, what came first? The psychedelics or the music, or did it come at the same time?
Oh, well, the music came really much earlier because, like, Tim Kaine and I were in a band in high school and a grammar school. The first band
so
was at the end.
Where'd you pick up your instruments? School music class or your parents?
No, I'd been playing guitar since I was about 3 years old. So
you had your own guitar?
I had my own guitar.
A little guitar?
Well, no, Dan Electro, I mean, nobody was going to spend a lot of money on me. But pretty quickly, I had a Stratocaster and a nice little amplifier. But my dad wasn't a fool. He wasn't going to go out and buy me a great guitar. And my dad had one of the first Les Pauls that was given to him by Gibson. And so, I mean, there was this amazing guitar to play and practice on.
So even at three, you sat down and you started working on
it? Well, I could barely hold it. I could just play a couple little chords, but I've got some funny pictures of me sitting there.
I'd love to see those pictures.
But, you know, it was very infectious, just the sound of a nice chord.
It is. Very relaxing, too.
Yeah, just one thing led to another.
And your brother's playing, too.
Yeah.
So did you play with your siblings?
No, not too much because there was a 7-year difference between us. And so he kind of independently developed. And when Tim started playing, he was much more into orchestration and, you know, bigger bands and, you know, symphony stuff. I mean, he's really got so much more stuff
going
on.
More classical training. Yeah. Where are you in the lineup, by the way? I forgot to ask
you. I'm the oldest.
You're the oldest.
Yeah.
Okay. So back to your bands.
Mm-hmm. Countdowns was the first one, and that was in high school. And then, in grammar school, into grammar school.
And who's in that band?
That was Tim and me and this guy Bill Tierney and Pete Metz, who I think he had already had a kid, Mexican guy, really great, already had a child in the 8th grade.
Wow. You know, that was pretty outrageous back then.
Yeah, but you know, he was great with cars. And in the end run, most everybody we thought that was a loser ended up, you know, being like, you know, head of a construction company, the head of the garbage company, you know, an amazing mechanic, and they all did really quite well.
Uh-huh.
We had it totally wrong as far as what it took.
So go on about your band.
So then in high school, I'm not quite sure when the Opposite Six formed. I wasn't in the initial Opposite Six. I didn't join that until the very end and just only played a handful of gigs.
So it was Rob Moitosa.
Yeah.
Bill. You know, I live in the Moitosa house.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah. I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. Rob Moitosa, Bill Champlin.
Tim Kaine. Don Irving was the guitar player. I'm trying to remember the name of the other saxophone player. Italian guy. And the drummer was... Dick Rogers.
Uh-huh. I've seen, you know who's my neighbor who owns, used to own Village, or still does Village Music. He's got a picture of the Opposite Six, I think, in his house hanging on the wall.
They were great. But, you know, we all, before that, we would all go and see the Countdown, not the Countdowns, but the Chord Lords. And the Chord Lords, Rob was in the Chord Lords with Dean Ferguson and, I forget what Ginsey's first name was, but he... You know, those gigs always turn into big fights and,
and... You mean like brawls?
Brawls and stuff like that. And, you know, not right on the dance floor, but there was always like an alarming flop fight that freaked everybody out for a while until it
you
got
mean
worked out.
It, like, when I interviewed Austin DeLone, he said you slow down, but you don't stop playing. You have to... play through the brawl.
Oh, yeah. No, and that in Texas is much more brawly. Usually it was about a pack of cigarettes or a girl, you know.
Yeah, anything.
Yeah.
Just
anything. A little
any
too much alcohol and a couple of alpha pumped up guys, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, at that particular time, then...
So you played a little bit with the Opposite Six.
At the very end, when Don Irving got hired by the Bo Brummels, and then they wanted to keep the band together. But I was a great guitar player, but I wasn't doing steps or any of that. That's not how, you know.
What are steps?
You know, steps like the band. The Opposite Six was amazing. They had all the steps.
Oh, you mean they were like dancing?
They had dance routines. They had all this stuff.
Oh,
I mean, they were really, they were
very cool.
Well, we all wanted to go to Las Vegas. And John Allaire was one of our heroes. Like, we'd go everywhere to hear Allaire and Pete Lind and Don Cox, I think, was the guitar player's name. And I remember when John came back from, they got their first big gig in Vegas. And he comes back and he goes, "It's not what you think it is. You end up playing six sets. And the stripper dances for an hour, then you play a set, and you get done at 5 in the morning, and you do that every night, and the people are rude, and it's terrible." And so immediately, okay, we didn't want to be Las Vegas musicians anymore. And the reason we wanted to is because there was like this band called the Big Beats that was just so amazingly great, and Sam Butera and the Witnesses, and I mean, there was a handful of really great Vegas acts, but... You know, it wasn't us. And so what I did is I subbed for my dad because he was one of the two top guitar players in San Francisco. So immediately that led to me doing musicals at the Curran Theater and...
You mean you were playing in the plays, musicals.
Yeah. Oh,
so
yeah,
you're performing in that little invisible sink down in front of the...
And I played in a band with his friend Al Troby at the... palace, the Sheraton Palace, the Tudor Room there in the corner. And so that was a regular gig. And Jerry Hahn and I split that gig as, you know, we were going to school.
Okay. So what grade are you here?
I'm 16, so just old enough to drive. So I think that's what, like a sophomore or a junior? Probably a junior.
What's it like for a young man in his budding manhood to be out in the city performing and around all those actors and performers and the nightlife that comes?
I've always been so clueless. I mean, and back in those days, I was so insecure about myself. You could have been the most beautiful woman I could have wanted you more than anything in the world. And if you came up to me, I would have just gone.
And what I'm looking at is a man who freezes.
Yeah, oh my God.
He absolutely
terrified
freezes.
Terrified me. Oh my God.
Ooh, all the wasted opportunities you must have had.
Well, another blessing, right? I just, this, they come in funny ways.
Yeah. Yeah, there's another side to that, too.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, you know, it's like I have great relationships with everybody I've ever been with. And, I mean, that's what I'm living right now about my relationship with Bill. I just feel like it's so filled with heart and love. And, you know, maybe we won't do much play together. But, you know, there's, a mutual recognition of this voyage. And you really do want to end it on a high note if you can.
So let's talk about the Sons of Champlin. Tell me about how that came to be. And
well, when the guys in the opposite six left, first it was Don leaving. And then I was playing guitar, and it seemed like maybe they were going to keep going. But then Dick Rogers, the drummer, got drafted. And so that just put a hole in
the
whole
thing. So
this
is the mid-60s now.
Yeah, this is probably 1965, you know, beginning of 65. And you know, Tim and Bill are a lot better on the time frame, but that's roughly it. And so I was talking to Tim, and he said, well, you want to start a band, you know, my friend. You know, Bill, basically, we need to put together something else. So.
And Bill's here and living in Mill Valley, going to Tam High.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we started rehearsing at my house in San Anselmo. We had two or three rehearsals there. And we met this guy, John Prosser, and Jim Myers, bass and drums. And that was actually really an excellent band. And my dad was really connected with the first commercial recording studios, ComSpot. And my dad did all the music for Don Sherwood's TV shows. Don was his best friend. So we spent a lot of time.
What were some of those shows? Remind me.
Don Sherwood was like the number one disc jockey and not a disc jockey, radio talk show host in San Francisco. And he was famous all over. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of like the model for all these really famous talk show hosts now. So seeing I knew Don personally, and my dad had managed to get actually the first early group of the Sons, like some nice work with doing White Levi's ads and things like that, that through all those connections, we were able to submit some of our music and tunes to Frank Werber, who was managing the Kingston Trio.
Frank Werber. Oh, my gosh. I haven't heard that name for a long time.
Frank was so influential for me as far as the herb thing, because he had the greatest herb ever. And it was the highest echelon and the Kingston Trio and, you know, racing at Laguna Seca. And I met the person who provided him with his weed. And he said that once a month he provided the Disney Art Studio with a half a pound of this amazing weed.
Now, for those that don't know, you might want to just say a little bit about Frank Werber, because I don't think his name has come up. But when I first moved to Mill Valley in the 70s, late 70s, Frank was one of those people that you heard about one way or another, and then, of course, the Kingston Trio.
He managed the Kingston Trio, mm-hmm. and he was one of the top, you know, music managers with the highest grossing acts for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And so in the industry, he was, like, really important. He was real good friends with Herb Albert. Albert is, you know, he put his record companies together. But on the side of all that, because he ended up managing the Sons, and we did really a very fun record. I don't know if you've heard that record.
I don't know.
Oh, my God, you got to hear that record. If you want to hear me sing, I'm singing lead on two or three tunes on it.
Okay.
And I listen back to it, and I go, I sounded good. I should have sung. But, you know, there was too much tripping with the singing. I didn't want to get involved with who's going to argue about who's singing what or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to sing. Mm-hmm. But it's a really beautiful album, and there's just some amazing tunes on it. And a lot of them we bought, you know, because that's what you used to do is buy tunes from Chapel Hill, you know, and so one of our most beautiful tunes that we did was Shades of Grey. It was this beautiful, you know, tune that the Monkees eventually did, and we were just getting ready to release it, and the Monkees released it. And it was beautiful, and we had Yusef Lateef playing flute on it. It was
just remind me how it went, just a little. You don't have to sing it perfectly.
When the world and I were young just yesterday, life was such a simple game child could play. And it was easy just to tell right from wrong, easy just to tell, But it was a very nice tune. And I mean, yeah, you should definitely get a copy of that because it's really nicely done. Because you can hear all our adolescents, and it's a beautiful transition into the Sons. And even though we were the Sons, you know, and this is one of the places where I really differ with Tim and Bill, because the Sons are basically Tim and Bill and I. And when we met our manager Frank Werber, who was like cooking at the Fillmore when we did our audition, and he approached us saying, "You guys are really great. I'd like to help represent you guys." Terrible manager, incredible spiritual mentor, friend of Gary Snyder's, did all these poetry readings and
Frank.
Things they called, like I've moved on now to Fred Roth, our manager. That we met at the Fillmore.
Oh, Frank's gone, and then in comes somebody.
Yeah,
else.
Yeah. Let me go back a little bit and say. So we did the album with Frank. We ended up meeting Fred at the Fillmore. Fred was connected with this man Albert Saijo, and Fred basically was a photographer, and he did these shows with Gary Snyder,
the poet.
The poet. Albert was friends with, you name it, Ginsberg and Alan Watts. And so we met Alan Watts, and we never really hung with Gary, but Gary was so influential in his poetry, and he was so influential in that group of people. Albert had been a Buddhist monk before he took LSD, and he always still maintained that Buddhist, view, and he was like the guru for everybody. He was just this amazing, wise man. And then Mark Watts, I met him through, Alan and through Albert. And
he's just a young man at that time.
Oh, yeah, no, he was younger than us at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there were so many Watts. I mean, there were so many Watts. There was so many.
This is one of many.
Yeah, many. He had no problem.
I think Alan Watts must have been as prolific with his reproduction as he was with his verbiage. I mean, that guy could produce.
I remember this one meal that we had at Albert's, and because we'd go up there all the time, and he'd talk about Buddhist things, and, we just couldn't get enough of it. And one day he says, "If you guys want, you can come back to dinner, because Ali Akbar Khan has just come to this country, and he's coming over here, and he's going to have dinner. And Alan Watts is going to come, too." And so I think, Bill and I, and I don't know if Tim, I forgot exactly who went, but there was a few of us there. And we show up, and, we're all sitting on the floor with this big—
And where are you sitting?
In Mill Valley.
Which house?
It was on Eldridge.
Okay.
And it has a swimming pool down below, and I forget the address of it. And a big, beautiful old Mill Valley house. So we show up for the dinner, and Kansav hasn't shown up yet, and Alan hasn't showed up, but Albert and his wife, Anne, are fixing the table. And Albert brings out this bottle of Chivas Regal, and alcohol was completely like a bad, bad, bad thing. Now we're all taking acid, and we're anti-alcohol. And he looked at us and he says, well, you know, Kansab comes from a different place and alcohol's really what they do. So it was, you know, it was a really nice organic hippie meal. And, you know, he's just, Kansab's over there drinking and Alan's drinking and they're sucking this bottle down and we're over there watching and, you know, Alan's just flying and talking and all the while, the young women that we've met brought to the thing, you know, Kansab's kind of reaching over and grabbing them and stuff. And we're just shocked because culturally we're completely naive. We have no idea what it's like out there in the rest of the world, you know. So after the meal, like, we really just kind of, like, it was explained to us that, you know, no, it's different over there in India.
It doesn't sound like you were entirely comfortable.
Well, it just didn't seem quite right, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, here we're trying to shed the yoke of, like, the repression and the straight people, and, like, all of a sudden we're realizing that some of the highest icons are just, like, amazing, like, wild, self-centered drunks.
Isn't that saying that you don't ever want to meet the people that you most admire? You know, best to keep them in that idolized version of what you imagine rather than see them for who they really are.
Oh, yeah. No, I think I've been really kind and considerate to everybody, but I've had my moments of really not being too happy with who I was. So even though I don't think anything ever rose to the level or anybody held it against me, it really pointed out how easy it is to get caught up in your story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And being just insecure enough or for whatever reasons of power or influence to be able to just expand it out into some, like, you know, hyperbole.
Right. So before the interview, you were talking about Sons of Champlin and getting the story out there. Now you're in the Sons now, and mm-hmm. you're performing. Here are some of the musicians that I've interviewed, what they've said about the Sons of Champlin.
Mm-hmm.
Marty Balin said it was the most real rock and roll band of the Bay Area, basically.
Oh, yeah. I think it was, without a doubt, the most intellectual band, you know?
Huey Lewis says wonderful things about the Sons of Champlin.
Oh, yeah, no, I knew his mother long before I knew Huey.
He says she was the star of the family.
Oh, Magda, oh, my God, she was amazing. When I met Magda the first time, it was at Albert's house, and his swimming pool was downstairs, and so here's Magda and David Brown down there in the pool naked, and it was still a little hard for us to get naked, but
there's,
you know,
your friend's mom. Wow.
I didn't know Huey at the time. I think I think he was still at Dartmouth and hadn't come back yet.
So I've heard it from several other musicians of the day that the Sons of Champlin were considered to be pure musicians.
We were
technically advanced.
Oh, yeah, we did all those different things. And we were so highly influenced by Fred Roth. I have to go back. Fred Roth, it was almost like he was a bipolar person because he had some real highs and he had some pretty dark lows. He was never mean, but he would really withdraw inside at certain times. But when he would take LSD, his whole body, it would all of a sudden just explode into this white, fuzzy energy around his whole body. And I'd seen him any number of times laying on the ground, just like in this, you know, hallelujah kind of state of mind.
Eyes shut, looking up,
just with this amazing aura all around him. And you could hear it. It actually made this, like, hissing sound almost of energy coming off of him. I mean, really a truly amazing, amazing human being. And for me personally, he was like everything from the dad that I never really had to the most incredible spiritual teacher. I mean, so in a lot a lot of reason for me to want to do this interview is to really give those people their due and how influential they were to the Suns. And, you know, it was always the Suns, but the Suns that's dear to me and the one that I think really was socially impactful and influential was the Suns between when we first took LSD and met Fred Roth to...
And that is 65-ish?
Yeah, but like when Welcome to Dance was the last really pure Suns thing. You know, the Circle Filled with Love was an amazingly nicely produced album, but everything had gone to Hollywood at that point, and the direction that Bill and I were going was really very, very different. So, and I think that's, you know, Bill from the very moment that I knew about him was so good and so clear about what he wanted to do in life, and in all fairness to him, he really got wrapped up in this amazingly energetic, expanded thing, and it didn't really represent his deepest desires to be, you know, really commercially successful, and not from a superficial place, just like he really wanted to be the best Bill he could possibly be, there was lots of that I didn't understand, because as soon as I saw the revolution and the radicalness of what we were involved in, that's where I wanted to go. And that's, I had felt very strongly that was the Suns' mandate. And Bill and I took LSD together for the first time.
And you mean the first time you ever took LSD, you did it with Bill?
Yeah, it was the most amazing thing, because we got dropped off at the top of the mountain, Mount Tam, at about maybe 10 o'clock in the morning. And we had an agreement with, I think it was Fred or somebody, to meet us at Alpine Dam, like in the later afternoon, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock. And my God, we just got so amazingly high. And I remember seeing Bill lay there very much like Fred with all this like energy coming out of him. And then out of nowhere, all these little birds came in and they just landed all over him. They're just like, you know, just diving into this just energy that's coming out of dude, you know? And, you know, Bill was always really very complex. So, you know, good man, very complex. And so sometimes he was very approachable, other times he wasn't. So to be able to really access that part of Bill really took a lot of safe area for that to really come out. But I really felt right from there that I really knew him, that I had a spiritual connection with him, and that we were there on the, kind of the same reincarnation mandate. And you know, how insulting for somebody to feel like they know somebody like that, you know, but nonetheless, that's how I felt, and I still do. And so a lot of the dialogue between me and Bill is me going, oh, this is spiritual stuff. I don't want to make a mistake. I don't care how much we get along or we don't get along. You're still one of the spiritual mentors for me, and I take the lyrics of your tunes and I bring them to the dying people so they'll feel better. So this is what I think, you know. And it's so great at this point in our life, you know. I hope he lives long and prospers, being as sick as he's been. But at this point, I think we both really recognize a deep love and respect for each other. And we're slowly, you know, it gets very warm. And okay, that's enough. But the wives are great. Like Tamara, I've always been deeply connected to Tamara, mm-hmm. and she loves Katie, and they both look at me and Bill and they laugh at us. Guys.
What kind of acid were you doing then?
Well, way back then I knew Owsley, and so, and he was influential with my marijuana growing
so
too.
Talk about him. Because well, there's people that are going to be listening to this interview that don't know about Owsley.
Well, I didn't know him that well. He was just part of the whole fixture of all the bands. We were managed by this company called West Pole, and it was Big Brother and Quicksilver and the Suns and the Ace of Cups and Freedom Highway. So because we were involved with so many of the really first wave psychedelic bands or, you know, 60s bands, we just got to meet everybody. And Bear and I hit it off really well. And because just energetic.
Bear,
that's what they called Ashley, you know. And so we hit it off really well. And I remember that the Avalon Ballroom, him coming and going, putting a little pouch, little leather pouch in my hand. And he did this with all the bands. And it had like about, you know, 30 hits of LSD that he'd made and some White Lightnings and some Purple Hazes. And I mean, just really the amazingly strong stuff. And I mean, that White Lightning, that was probably the strongest LSD, I mean, I personally had ever seen, you know.
You know how many mics it was?
I think they were only 250.
Mm-hmm.
Or they might have been more than that because they were designed to be cut up. So they might have actually been 500 or even 1,000, but we just took a whole one. And then that was one of my greatest experiences with Bill ever is we took the White Lightning and we went up above Kent Lake. And it's not like we were really intimately physically close, but we were so high. And we were sitting there and we were looking at each other. And at least on my side, we just de-evolved through every life form, you know, monkey, single-celled creature, like all the way into like, you know, just like being out. And so that's another place where I always felt that was my true connection with Bill is like, you know, being an evolved being, you know. And almost all the lyrics on the first album, and this is just my opinion, were things that were told to us by the poets and Albert and Fred, you know, because we didn't know anything about Hinduism or Buddhism or any of that level of thought, but it was this just wash of Eastern philosophy and Eastern religion. And they really are all Bill's lyrics in the sense that he's a great writer. And he took that stuff and really turned it into incredibly contemporary, compelling, you know, pointed, you know, ways of talking about everything. And it was so good that Gary Snyder for a long time wanted to come and read poetry between our shows. But we, you know, it was just like a little too uncouth for him. He was a little bit more sophisticated than
Gary was.
Yeah, reading poetry between like crazy rock and roll bands.
Well, it's kind of a funny mix of energy because I remember the light shows back then.
Mm-hmm.
And the light shows seemed to be customized for people on psychedelics.
Oh,
you know.
Why are you there? Hello.
And that's really the thing that we're really the focus of what you're describing, as I understand it, is that so infused in that walk, that rock and roll of that time was the psychedelic experience, the expanding your mind, the breaking down the walls of perception, the reaching out and in and all around and finding the connection that is common in the humanity amongst us all. That's a lot of what that experience was with music.
I think initially that's what it was. And the interesting thing about being in the Suns, we were just that much younger, even though we may have been the most, you know, musically skilled group out of San Francisco for a while at least. We were a second-generation group, and so, like in a lot of ways, the college students that really had something to say that weren't musicians that taught themselves to be musicians, which was like a large portion of all the bands, you know.
Give me examples of the bands.
Yeah, well, I mean, like Grateful Dead or Big Brother or Charlatans or Quicksilver, or, you know, the iconic ones, mm-hmm. you know, Airplane. There was a lot of just learning how to play while that whole thing was going on. Because all of them were really smart. Everybody seemed to be really highly educated. And they were just on that cutting edge of, you know, the end of the Beats and the beginning of psychedelia. And we came into it just that much later to where we knew everybody and everybody loved us and everything, but we were never really accepted into that.
You described kind of a kid brother thing. You know, like in comes the kid brother.
Right, right.
After the ice-breaking older brothers or sisters.
Mm-hmm, right,
is that
right.
How you felt?
Yeah, yeah, sure. And, you know, for a long time I would think, these guys aren't very good. But as I got to understand more and more what they did, when they did it, and what an amazing movement that whole first wave of San Francisco bands was, and how integrated it really was to the thing that I love, which is creative anarchy. And I don't think I was introduced to that, and we were introduced to that by our manager, Fred. That was kind of the rallying cry. And it's always been that for me. It's never changed. You know, I wanted to live a simple life as I could, use as little as I could. Never been involved with, worried about money. None of it ever really, you know, it was just like.
When I interviewed Marty, he said, I asked if he had any regrets. He goes, yeah, I should have gotten some contracts signed.
Yeah.
Well, the naivete of just the creative process, and then it becomes something more, becomes business, and didn't always pan out that the people that were creative were that creative with their business opportunities.
And the thing with Marty is like, and again, I don't know this personally, but I was just talking to Joel Selvin about this yesterday. And he said, well, you know, because he knew Marty really well and knew Joe really well. And he said, well, did you know that Marty was autistic? I said, no, I didn't. And he said, well, think about it. Think about how he was and how inward he was and what an effort it was to go out. But that's actually what made him Marty and made him really the best Marty you could be.
Interesting.
Yeah, I thought that's it.
When you talk about this creative anarchy, can you give me an example of a performance you were either in or observed where you felt that so strong, that communion amongst younger people where that was alive, that sense of creative anarchy?
Well, almost any gig from, like, you know, 1967 to 1972. Almost anyone had that in there, you know. I mean, I would always really spend a lot of time thinking about the unified field of consciousness. I would really pretty much just pray for an opening, the grace of connecting, and the passing it on quality of the experience. So every time we played wasn't a finite thing. It was like a pretty infinite thing with infinite possibilities. And so that's why the audience and the Suns loved me. Not so much. Maybe my guitar playing was pretty good, but I think I just had a connection with everybody. I'd really make a point of talking to everybody about what mattered, you know, or what mattered to them. And it was always really quite the experience of getting on the stage and just looking at everybody and just looking really lovingly and looking and just not playing, but just looking and just being there and feeling more and more people looking and eventually like, I'm looking at you and you're looking at me and we're setting up this dynamic and then we would play. And I know lots of people felt that that was happening. And to me, that's what the Suns was about. I kind of got lost in paying too much attention to the individual tunes or the careers or the ambitions because I never really believed much in that. From an early age, I kind of came to the conclusion that ambition was probably not helping the feeling of unified consciousness. I felt like it was kind of going the opposite direction. So
that ultimately resulted in going on different paths for you?
Yeah, well, the band made a lot of things happen with the band, and I don't want to really get in any specifics of who did what or why or anything like that. Just at some point, there was too much alcohol, too much bad drugs, too much ambition, and I just realized that the thing that I held dear was not, there wasn't a possibility it was going to happen. Not that it wasn't by the time you died going to get resolved and everybody was going to find their true spiritual self. But that particular incarnation and who, what I considered to be the sons, came and went. So, you know, again, for me, and it's just my own view and highly biased and probably not very true, but we're a psychedelic band with a really true, loving message, and that was our most powerful time ever. And all the rest of it was, you know, I mean, if that satisfies you to be famous or that satisfies you to be whatever, I mean, far be it from me to say anything about it. But whether I was dumb or evolved, which I can't really figure out, I threw all my chips over here, you know?
The temptations of fame, the temptations of being that guy on the stage with the guitar and all those adoring eyes on you, the, you know.
It can be an amazing thing because once it gets in your mind and your mind starts running with it, God, hopefully your parents were good and taught you some things. It doesn't get carried away.
Yes, exactly. But can we talk a little bit about that since you're such an honest man?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, because one of the things, like, you know, just as a transition is, in my life, as I've gotten older and older, and the mothers of my children are amazing women and really highly educated and incredible parents. And I just learned, even though my father was pretty abusive and that was really difficult, that parenting is everything. Education is everything, you know, like, and without a real bias in directing your kids, but it has to be there. It's just...
So when you are on the stage, and it's the later years of the Sons, and I remember very well, there was so many things going on simultaneously in the 60s. Mm-hmm. There was the reactions to the Vietnam War and the kind of patriotism that was being challenged that mm-hmm. In the United States. There was the pill, mm-hmm. and now women have freedom of choice and the ability to, there's a sexual revolution. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, there's all kinds of new drugs that expand consciousness and further break down those walls that younger people at that time felt constrained by, but their parents were held up by, you might say, or defended, especially post-World War II. And so there was, I remember very well as watching my older sister and brother, just wild. Mm-hmm. And that could be, yes, a lot of fun on the one hand, but terrifying to watch if you've got young people making decisions that, as a parent, you might say, this is highly threatening to me mm-hmm. as far as the security. But at the same time, the energy that's being created and is fulminating in this, as you described it, this this creative anarchy, mm-hmm. it's narcotic in itself. You feel this, like my older sister used to say, we are all brothers and sisters in the revolution of life. Mm-hmm. There was this unity, and there was a sharing, and there was an openness that didn't exist in a previous generation for a lot of reasons. And so a byproduct of that was some pretty reckless and wild behavior. And there's groupies. Mm-hmm. And there's drugs, and there's money, mm-hmm. and there's fame, and then music becomes big business, and then there's commercialism.
Well, you know what? I really avoided it in the music business, but when the Sons broke up, because I was such a geneticist with marijuana already, and while I was on the road, I always grew it, and I was always working on collecting the seeds and growing my own varieties. But when the Sons broke up, the first time, I think that was 77, all of a sudden I'd created so many connections, because the model back in the late 60s was that the dealers went and got the sacrament and the musicians played the sacred music, and we were going to change the world that way. But it was a very simplistic way of looking at it. Nobody factored in what the drugs the dealers were going to get or anything like that. But it was still really had this very compelling narrative. And inside of that, because the dealers were always bringing their best to the bands.
Like their offerings.
Their offerings, yeah.
Yes.
And so literally I met some of the most amazing big-time dealers, you know, the Goldfingers and the Big Jerrys and like all these people, my friend Deacon. I mean, like really international, amazing people and sometimes dumb people. And so when the band broke up, it's hard to give it a definition. But anyway, I ended up having a period of time where I was doing a lot of deep breathing exercises and a lot of yogi bhajan practice. And my kundalini got going so intense that I had so much energy going through me that it was literally like if you would touch me, you'd have kriyas too. Mm-hmm. So for a couple of years there, I was just about in a cloistered state kind of dealing with it. I remember reading this thing from Muktananda, and they were asking, well, what's the most difficult part of your life? And he says, most difficult part is integrating Shaktipat into my life, because even now, as old wise guy, it's still the infinite energy of life. Mm-hmm. So I really reached this kind of really almost incapable of doing much anything other than really have these amazing energy movements and then come back and spend time with Baba Hari Das and did all this, you know, Ayurvedic, you know, healing and cooling in my body. And I'd lost the ability to make any money. So all my dealer friends started fronting me herb. And I started selling herb. And I had the best price of anybody. So I started selling more herb and started making more money. And one thing led to another, and I pretty much got stabilized. And then I was just humping away. You know, the truck full of pot was coming down, and the suitcases.
Was it coming from Northern California or Mexico?
Oh, no, this is way pre that. You know, Mexico. And Colombia and Thailand, and you know.
Is statues up for, and some of these people are dead,
for that
like
stuff.
Goldfinger.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember the amazing story about him.
There's no statue for LSD, so basically you can't be talking about.
Okay, so we won't talk about LSD.
And there's a number of people that basically they would love to know, and I can say that I don't know them.
I'd love to do an anonymous interview, but I do remember the story about Goldfinger, where he has a plane full of pot, and he's in Mexico, and he's on the plane, and the propeller cuts his arm off.
Oh, no, that was in Mexico. Here's the story.
Let's get the real story.
He had a plane full of pot. He landed at Knoss Field in Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
The propeller, he backed into the propeller with his hand and with his head. The thing just barely nicked his head, took his hand off. He went and had his hand cauterized. They couldn't put it back on. The technology wasn't there at the time. Had his head sewed up, took a bunch of LSD, and went to a Grateful Dead show. The reason I know this is because Steve Parrish told me. You know, I just did an interview with Steve a while ago, and we talked about all these guys and our relationship with them. And, I mean, it was really, really a trip. But
didn't Nikki Scully have a daughter, Acacia, with him? Wasn't that Goldfinger, his daughter?
Maybe. I don't know. But he was a wild guy. And, again, I can't claim that I knew him that well. I had
I heard a very different story about that.
Yeah, there's plenty of them.
There's plenty of them. The urban legend of these kinds of things.
Yeah, they all go. But that, the person that really tied me in everywhere, and I can talk about him because he's dead also, was Deacon.
Mm-hmm.
And Deacon's parents were diplomatic aides to, you know, any number of countries. And so he had all these amazing...
And he what did he do?
What? But he basically dealt gems and smuggled. But a really wonderful guy, really incredibly interesting, you know, really, really a very deep Buddhist person inside his world of privilege and wildness, you know?
You know, what did they used to say back then about having, it wasn't such a, no mandatory sentencing. It wasn't too difficult if you got busted for pot, and they'd say, go to Lompoc and 6 months or a year and make good connections while you're there.
Well, that's probably the truth. I got busted, but was only a small amount of pot and went all the way to trial in Marin County. And I had Brian Rohan as my lawyer. And as the case is going on, I'm just deciding that my lawyer is so incompetent. And I stand up, and Peter Allen Smith was the judge. And I said, Your Honor, I want to fire my lawyer. And he looked at me and he says, that's the first reasonable thing I've heard. So I just told him the whole thing. I said, this is what I did. And he said, hey, well, first and foremost, he's a friend of my dad's because my dad was the assistant county recorder and nobody's examining these things enough to recuse yourself from anything. Mm-hmm. So he's looking at me, he goes, okay, 6 months probation and don't do it again. And so I go to the probation officer and the probation officer is the fan and he goes, here's your forms, fill them out, make sure you send one in every... every month send one of these things in. Yeah. So that was the only skirt that I actually did get indicted in Nevada for knowing this group of people that ended up being one of the most amazing, sophisticated group of smugglers. And they had developed a code that couldn't be broken. And so the DEA got it in their head that I was the code keeper. So,
uh-oh.
And the case was based in the state of Nevada. So in early in the morning, I'd get calls from the prosecutor saying, we're going to get you. And then they'd hang up. And they did everything. They came and they'd wait until I'd take my garbage out and I'd be walking down and they'd drive up in their car and they'd take the garbage and throw it in the trunk. And it was all just to try to intimidate
yes.
me. And eventually the person who'd rolled over on me, it was a wife of one of them. And it turns out that he just had this phone book and my name was in it. And he started doing cocaine and, you know, getting obsessed with weapons and beat her really badly. And she was so pissed, she took the whole book and turned it into the feds. So all of a sudden, like, I was this most high-profile person they could recognize.
And so they went for you.
Oh, and they went
tried
for me.
To
yeah.
torque you.
Yeah. And but luckily, I knew everybody, and I had all this pro bono work from these amazing lawyers. And
eventually, they used to be famous sometimes.
Yeah. No, and between the main witness refusing to testify against me and having really good lawyers, I skated that. And I think that was my last really – I was really involved with Hawaii right from the very beginning of Hawaiian marijuana because I knew the Brotherhoods so well in Southern California, and they brought all these amazing genetics to Maui. And then
and you say the word brotherhoods, and not everybody will understand.
Brotherhood of Eternal Light and Love, that's what they call themselves.
Yeah. So why don't you explain that a little bit more? Because there were sort of like families of, I guess you could say there were crime families because it was illegal, but at the time it was more of a brotherhood.
Well, the brother, that was really all pretty, you know, it was like if you had like – 50 guys that were smugglers that all looked like they were members of the Eagles. Like, that was just like the most handsome, cool guys, and everybody drove Porsches, and, you know, and there was based out of Laguna Beach, and the mayor was part of it. And I mean, it was really quite the deal. And they had this house out there in Laguna Niguel, and Tim Leary was there, and these big LSD parties would happen. But, you know, eventually the friends that I knew, they got, you know, busted, and they literally tore their whole houses down and then dug the property up about 10 feet deep to find all the amazing amounts of money and hash.
You mean the mandate?
The feds. Yeah, the DEA. Yeah, but so anyway, but there, they brought in a lot of amazing genetics from Afghanistan, and that all moved over to Maui. And by that time, that was right at the end of the time that the Suns was breaking up.
And this is what year?
Oh, 75. You know, Suns broke up in 77. And I was already pretty much providing the amazing stash to lots of the bands and
drug dealer to the stars.
Well, and to the other dealers. You know, like my stuff was so crazy expensive and inaccessible, only the richest people could buy it. And
there was so you'd become like the.
That's where I'm going with it.
Yeah.
So, for all my anger about the sellout,
yes,
I ended up being seduced into this thing, and just step by step by step by step, all of a sudden I found myself really. With this group of people that was not good. And it all culminated in going on this boat ride, really big, like, you know, 120, 130 foot long yacht in San Francisco Bay. And the admission for everybody to get on the boat was like, you know, 2 platinum Krugerrands apiece. And this was, you know, back there in the 70s. So, that you know, it's a lot of money. But everybody had it. So I'm standing on board with a guy that I know who's been fronting me all my stuff and looking out in the distance, and I see this boat coming. It's a big old boat, and I realize it's a cigarette boat, and the thing's just going, and it starts spinning around the big yacht, and it's got this tripod, and guys are filming everybody, and all the people that were on deck fled as soon as they saw the boat. Everybody went down below.
So this is the DEA.
Yeah. So I'm standing on board with my friend and friend, really not a friend, but standing up there, and the guy down in the boat yells at him, says, "Hey, Charles!" And Charles answers him, and I said, "Well, who's that?" He said, "Oh, it's the DEA."
So you're with your friend who's answering to the DEA?
Yeah, yeah.
So
they all know each other. And he says, "Oh, they've been trying to get me for years." And the guys that were on this boat were all like Pakistanis and Middle Eastern people. And I mean, I swear, just every one of them looked like they'd killed somebody. And I eventually just came to. I just went, "Oh, my God.
I'm in bed with some creepsters.
How in the world did I end up with such how did this even happen, you know? Oh, my God, I'm done, you know?" So I got out of the indictment, and then I just went into the whole genetic part of the herb, and just, you know, growing just enough. Joel wrote me a really nice review that basically sums it up. He says, "If you were lucky enough to get this, you'd know that it was the best ever." But nobody did, because there wasn't much. So it was mm-hmm. all personal favor to me to different people. You know, Paul Kantner would get a little, you know, like people like that. Right?
So that what you're describing, and I think it's really important if we're being honest in the history mm-hmm. of Mill Valley mm-hmm. and Sausalito and the Bay, is that there was a drug culture going on, and not just of taking drugs, but this was business, big business, millions and millions and millions of dollars and ships and boats and organizing. And these people were living in Mill Valley and Sausalito and San Anselmo and Hawaii.
And they were all the richest people. And you know what? It's still like that in a lot of ways, even though it's different, but those things still exist. But the Marin County thing really culminated. You know, the cocaine showed up. People started dealing a lot of cocaine. And again, I just removed myself from that completely. But kind of the culmination of it as far as awareness, people becoming aware of how bad it was these guys getting executed at the Howard Johnson there in the late 70s, I think it was, early 80s. Cocaine deal gone bad. You can find it in the IJ, I'm sure. You know.
Oh, so over by where the Holiday Inn Express
Yeah, where that's, it used to be the Howard Johnson.
Right, so I've forgotten about that.
Yeah, so, and that was like the, that was just like the, like, oh my God, you know, people are killing each other now, you know.
Right, because I remember in the 70s, when we were in high school, you could go to Garberville and pick bud for money to pay for your college, and the ladies in the town had their tea and they would clean with you, and it was all pretty open. It was a benign kind of agriculture at that time, which now it's very different.
And, you know, and the funny thing is that then that's always been kind of a consistent underpinning of a lot of people surrounding this whole music scene for a long time. And it's not that way anymore. And Pete, we're all older, and that was a different time of our life. But I think the last echoes of that were when we got together after being broken up for 20 years. So
the Sons of Champlain Garden.
Yeah. 97, 96, whenever it is, we got together and did that series of Fillmore shows. And then we were trying to make a go of it again. And we signed with Grateful Dead Records, and they gave us $15,000, I think it was, for promotional to have somebody go in front of each town and do our promotional stuff. So we
you mean
just,
like the press packet dealies the interviews and the newspaper?
So a well-known person in the Grateful Dead organization, not to be named, ended up being hired to do that. But and we were so optimistic about it, you know. But that person just checked into the Navarro Hotel in checked into the Navarro Hotel in New York and spent all the money on drugs, and we lost sight of him for the whole tour.
I know who you're talking about. It's not a good thing to give a
and you know, that particular person I really thought was wonderful and really loved him. We were always happy to see each other forever until, you know, things moved on. But it was just like, ah, nothing's changed. Ah, this is terrible, you know.
Drugs can make good people do bad things.
Yeah, no, and then basically I had to get out of that one too. It was a combination of, I don't know if I was fired or I quit, but it doesn't matter. I had to go.
When we talked earlier in the pre-interview, you talked about some of the people you've known, and let's go back to psychedelics. Terrence McKenna.
I met him. I can't really claim that I know him. I've got friends that want me to go and hang with his wife. They said, you guys would just really hit it off. Yeah.
I went to listen to him speak when I was living in Boulder, and I remember he said, my preferred method of death is, if I'm going to die, I'd like it to be death by astonishment.
Oh, well, you know, everything that he said was stuff that...
Clever.
Well, it's all stuff that we thought of long before, you know? Whether it was transpermia or the consciousness of mushrooms, or the, you know, the microwave, you know, and the consciousness of it, you know, the intergalactic, you know, nature of all of it. Those are all things that you actually experience that are quite real, you know?
And now they're being studied, and there's kind of a revival.
Yeah, yeah.
With
most definitely, yeah.
Yeah. Let's progress on a little into the work that you do. Well, you know, first of all, let me think for a moment. Have we spoken enough about your musical ability?
Represented? I don't need that.
I mean, do you feel like you're a good musician? Do you feel like your music represents?
No, I usually feel like I'm not. I wish I was better. I really feel like I'm a fraud a lot of times. But my great gift is I really love people, and they know that, and they love me, and there's a lot of us in the experience. So, and that's what I wanted to do anyway, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't ambitious enough to really practice, or, you know, I wasn't ever going to be making. I wanted to pick wild mushrooms and sit in the woods, and you know, I don't know that there was, you know, enough compelling stuff in the music business for me to change my overall trajectory of that. I wanted to end my life in a state of deep meditation in a fairly peaceful place with people that I love.
Have you ever met a musician that goes on to this uber successful career who's like Bob Dylan or somebody? Can you find peace with that kind of...
Oh, I think a number of those people have. I think, you know, first and foremost, I think the intellects of a lot of those people so far outweigh anything that my mind brings to it that it's not for me to even try to extrapolate. It's like trying to think about Pete Seeger and come up with anything other than, God, that was amazing. I mean, these are really amazing, like bodhisattvas incarnated into this world, you know, and they're supposed to be unfathomable. It's supposed to be unknowable. That's what makes a person great.
Who, when you think of names of people that just somehow, you've listed a lot of names. Who have you forgotten to list? Is there some people that you'd like included in this discussion, people that you'd like to be remembered for? For whatever influence they had.
Oh, one of the most soulful people is Taj Mahal. Oh, my God, Taj is great.
You played with him.
Well, we did shows with him.
Mm-hmm.
And Taj and I are friends. We don't see each other that much, but we have a whole history of musicians we know, so it's always really fun to hang out. And we check out all of that stuff, but I don't fit in anything. And that's one of the things. I just don't fit in anything. I am just me, and... Oh, it's just so heartfelt and devotional, but it really doesn't apply to much anything. And if you asked me to play on your stuff, I'd point out a bunch of reasons why there's somebody better you could get. And if you really convinced me that you knew what I was going to do or maybe do, then I'd do it. See, one of the things I always tell people, as I said, and I've had great experiences with this, is I come into the studio, they've got their music. When they call me on the phone to do it, I say, first and foremost, I don't want to hear any of your music. I don't want to know anything about your music. All I want to do is get in and set my guitar up, get a nice sound, and I want you to push record very first time I hear it, because that's when you're going to get the very best out of me. And then after we do that and my consciousness is free to just freely associate all the stuff, then we can go in and we can edit. We can select parts and then we can do the crafting. But I just don't want to have a plan. I don't want to hear it. I really don't. If that makes you insecure, then maybe I'm not your guy. But people that know me, they're just going, oh, shit, that's great. We're not going to sell any records at all, but that's great.
Any other influential people in the sense that they influence you, not just, you know, worldwide?
Oh, all great guitar players, doesn't matter, you know, if they're country western or all. If it had a guitar in there, it was really influential. And you know what? All these distinctions and all these things are true in the sense that for different parts of the country and the roots and the diasporas have created them. But there's no separation about the music other than music people had to make it that way so they had more product to sell to more different groups of people, you know?
Mm-hmm. You went on to, you were describing earlier about how you sort of, by force of nature or some kind of incredible magnetic attraction, have ended up being a guide for those that are dying.
Well, when I was having all my Kundalini things, it really took a lot out of me. And they went for so long. I mean, they went for so long, me just having these amazing energetic things.
And what does that feel like, to have an amazing energetic thing?
Oh, shit. You know? I mean, it's hard
like
to
just... hypermania type of thing?
No, because there's really some amazing consciousness, expanded consciousness in it. It's just a lot, you know? And for me, none of it was unfamiliar. I really felt like it was all part of things that I'd brought with me from earlier incarnations. None of it seemed out of reach per se, but one of the things Baba Haridas wrote down was that very dangerous, could kill you. And when you look at that kind of energy in the history of spiritual things, whether, you know, whatever the practice is, there's a lot that says about people that went about opening themselves up the wrong way, which is probably what I did. And so rather than really having that deep lineage of spiritual practices, you went off and did your own thing and you're kind of out there by yourself. And you might not be fixable enough to really actually ever really be accepted into a real lineage because, you know, a lot of the mechanism, subtle mechanism got broken with the thing overheating. So, but, you know, that said, you know, that's the path that I took. And it took so much energy out of me at one point. I ended up, my body just started breaking down. It couldn't go any further. And they took me to the hospital and couldn't figure out how to stop all the energetic things.
Was it happening. Like your RPMs were 6,000 and you were neutral or something?
Oh, no. I mean, you name it. Everything was just... torque to 10, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so they put me in an induced coma. This was at Stanford. And eventually it all cooled out, but it was such an intense experience that it really, really messed with my linear mind for a while. So when I got out of that, I almost... could hardly remember who I was.
And what
was
year is this?
That had to be 1980, 1981, right in there. And when I came out of that, I felt so grateful to be alive. I had never, ever felt such an appreciation of having a life. And because of the way I thought about these things and kind of thought about them in probably not a very clear Buddhist way, but even in my most distressing places, I always inside myself thought, this is really interesting. I mean, this is amazing stuff. I wonder what's happening here. This is just amazing. So as it went, whether it's the truth or not, I got a sense of the human bardo, being in the human bardo, getting to the edge of the human bardo. I really had a couple of amazing near-death experiences. And I had an experience of people praying for me where tangibly I could see the energy and feel the energy come to me and help me. So... lots of things that I knew existed, but I'd never had emotionally really impacted me. I walked away with a sense of, I know something. I don't know what it is that I know, and I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but if I could be of any assistance to anybody with this experience I've had, I'd like to make myself available. And the funniest thing, one of the things I think I learned was that I was raised a Catholic. Jesus was a big thing. Always loved Jesus. I loved the teaching. Never was buying any of the rest of it, you know. Hate religion. Not hate religion, but, you know, spirituality interests me. Religion is somebody's plan. It's not mine. But I went to St. Anselm's Church right from the hospital, and I just prayed in front of the altar, and I prayed to Jesus that I was going to dedicate my life to being available to anybody that I could benefit. And then I learned about Living Dying Project, and I submitted my bid to be part of that because they vet you, and I think I was right on the edge.
And the Living Dying Project is?
It's a Buddhist group, and it's, you know, Sogol Rinpoche, and, you know, like all the amazing people in the dying movement from the very beginning. And, you know, and Dale Borglum, the guy who runs it, is really quite the amazing human, and Ram Dass, and, you know, just, you know, really, really quite the group of special people. But they accepted me, and I had a number of clients, and because I was weird, I got all the weirdest clients, and got to watch a number of people pass in a number of different ways. And when I walked away from that, I kind of walked away from it thinking, well, you know, I've seen enough people die, and I'm always deeply emotionally moved by it, and maybe I need to take a little break from it. But what actually happened is then people started finding me. And there was a way that people would approach me that was just so compelling that I just had to say yes. And, you know, with that, you're pretty much agreeing to just ride the ride with them until they're gone. But the thing that I really learned was, and I think it's just basic Buddhist knowledge, is life happens on the human plane. Like I was saying earlier, when you get to the edge of it, there's amazing, you have amazing choices and amazing insights into how your next incarnation is going to go. And for people that feel that way, it's when you meet somebody that knows something, you know that they know it. And it's completely nonverbal. And most of the lessons of being with dying people happens when they lose their ability to communicate, because that's when all the real deep communications happens. So with the breath and the tonglen and all the different, you know, just who you are and how you see it. So, yeah, no, then it's been like, you know, 20 or 30 years of just meeting these amazingly interesting people, you know. I was just contacted by somebody that I know that's just going through ALS, and I had a couple of clients with ALS. I had this one client with ALS. She was so amazing. She had all the computer stuff that she triggered with her eye. And she was the most amazing pornographic author. She wrote this amazing pornography, and she's just in that little bit. I mean, the stuff was slamming. So, you know, that made perfect sense to me. I said, well, that's how the world looks to me. This is great. I'm glad to meet you.
Describing something that you can't participate in at all.
Yeah, but really.
With your eyes.
Yeah, really. The smell of the Mediterranean island with the wild herbs and the wild goats rutting on the hillside. And the goat smell and the herb smell and the human smell. I mean, she was so perfect in that. And you could literally just like, oh! But filled with love and, you know, really incredible markers as far as things that, you know, wow, good for you. I mean, I hope I'm the tenth of what you are when I get to that, you know, comparable place. Yeah.
Do you think about tomorrow, you think about?
I think like a Buddhist. Is today the day I die? I'd like to recognize something about it. Yeah, I'd like to think that there's some process inside there that's conscious enough. You know, like when you get in an accident or something like that, and everything slows down. I'm always thinking that I'm courting that part of my consciousness to where when. Really, my moment comes, however, if it comes abruptly, that I would have that facility to at least connect with that, you know. I'm sure I'd probably freak out and stuff, but part of me, just keep the thread alive, you know, for the
infinite. You mean the part that's watching you sort of freak out as you're going through, yeah, and then yeah. you're watching yourself yeah. while you're also going
yeah,
through.
Yeah, very well put, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just you know, the infinite continuum, just to not lose touch with that, you know. Far be it from me to be a decider about anything, you know.
Do you have any regrets?
I regret I got so mad at Bill. I wish I was wiser. He's one of the people that I deeply love. But you know what? I've got a will, and we're making it better, and it's all be good. So it's not a thing. Just so I think most regrets that I've had actually end up being a realization midstream in a conscious process that they all seem to work out just fine.
Anything you would say to... Any pearls to share for younger people that are listening to this?
Oh, you know, listen to your heart. Listen to... really pay attention to what things... Why, you know, not so much why, just pay attention to what matters. And... then find the thing inside there that really is, has, that's kind of a real humanistic part of it. Whether it's sex, whether it's money, whatever it is, there is really a deep part of it that's just part of being a human. So find the part inside your things that makes you a human, and you know, then do what you think is right. And when you find those, when you find the parts that make you a human, it just helps you make a more humanistic choice, and you're the one that benefits from doing those things.
Are you describing humility here?
Well, when that comes, that's fine. But I don't know. I think you can be quite arrogant and full of yourself and still have grace that guides your life. And eventually you'll find the humility. Yeah. I think the more gifted and more intelligent you are, probably, unless you're a deep spiritual being, that's probably going to come in the last 30 of your life. You know, or when you have children, there's going to be some experience where all of a sudden just don't want to pass down certain characteristics of your mind to anybody.
If you were to see yourself as a friend you're hanging out with, what would you say about yourself? You talk about Bill, but how about you?
He really does melt down a lot quicker than he should. He is pretty amazingly insecure. Hard to understand why he does that, because he really doesn't need to. But it seems to be something happened to him at some point that made that a real integral part of how he deals with the world. And that said, I think most everybody really loves me, and they look at me and they go, oh, it's okay. You'll be okay.
Sometimes.
We've seen it before.
Sometimes those very things can be so dear in the ones you love.
I have some really wonderful friends, and I can honestly say that if I'm really insecure and I'm having a hard time and my mind's running away with me, I can really trust them that the experience just stays with them and they just sit on it and it goes away and it wasn't a thing anyway. And it's how we help each other just move through the construct of what used to be.
Is there anything we haven't talked about that you'd like to close this interview with?
Well, God, may we all have the blessings of a higher being guiding us along and giving, you know, showing us grace and forgiveness, and may we be conscious enough to recognize the beings in front of us and the depth of their being. That's what this is about, you know? I mean, when I walk away from this interview, I'm not going to think about this interview at all. All I'm going to think about is your eyes and the depth of your soul, and the fact that it's just so deeply realized in you that you become me and it becomes us, and it's just like another little, you know, very affirming moment.
I agree.
But yeah, sitting there at that table, that's with this whole thing, and this is nice too.
Yeah. Terry Haggerty, thank you so much for giving me your story, sharing your story with all of us.
Thanks for asking so many nice questions. And
I like you. I hope we can keep a friendship.
Well, you know what? Oh, I'm so sorry about that. Well, you know what? I'm sure it's meant to be.
Yes, I think so too. Yeah. A lot of commonalities. On behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Public Library, I think we've concluded this interview. Agreed?
Great. Well, I think so. You know, if there's any one last thing I would have to say is that with your friends that you really believe in, that you know have a really deep spiritual core, sometimes the greatest blessings can manifest as spiritual emergencies because there's so much.
Mm-hmm.
So we all need to be there for each other at that level of awareness, because we're looking to always expand and grow into places that are a little scary. And everything that really has real content is a little bit scary. So
I agree with that.
Yeah.
But well put, sir. Well put. All right. I think that's a wrap.
Okay, we're good.